Cult Conference challenges Christian high school students to become the next generation of cultural leaders. Talks given throughout the week encourage high school students to put on the whole armor of God, engage culture, and advance the kingdom in all areas of life. Check out this year's Cult Conference by visiting calledconference.ninja. That's this summer, July 15th to the 20th, here in Moscow, Idaho. Sign up today for an early bird discount at calledconference.ninja.
All right, so we've said a number of times in this conference that the central area of confusion in our day is over issues of gender and sexuality, manhood, womanhood, masculinity, femininity. That's the thing right now, and will be the thing going forward that will be front and center for you in your lives. It's not a confusion that is isolated to one area of society. So there are certain kinds of issues that only some of you will have to deal with in terms of cultural leadership. Like if you go into politics, there's certain kind of issues that only you as a politician will have to deal with, and that somebody who goes into some other job won't have to deal with at all. This is one that gets into everything. Okay, because everywhere you go, there are men and women, and everywhere you go in our culture, there are men and women who are deeply confused and deeply broken, which means you can't avoid this. You've got to be able to do some careful thinking and living. So wherever you go, whatever arena you're in, you will be called upon to be cultural leaders, not just in resisting the confusion, but in embodying and expressing God's good design for men and women. And I want to highlight that. It's not mainly about like resisting something and like just hanging on for dear life. That's not what we're interested in. We actually want to push back the darkness, which means embodying and expressing God's good design for men and women. And let me just underscore something that we said, I think, on the panel the other night, but I did it real briefly, and I just want to use this as the intro. So I want you to think about out in the world, or out, you know, as far as like what influences you, and what shapes how you think about things. I want you to think about sort of three levels, okay? At the deepest level, you've got God, okay? And we'll go even further and say God as he reveals himself in the Bible. So the Bible, okay? The Bible is one of those things that shapes you. A second thing that shapes you is the world. And by the world, I mean nature, like the way God made you. So you've got the Bible, and then you've got the way that God made you. Follow me? So this is in theological terms, if you've ever done any study of theology, it's called special revelation, and it's called general revelation. It's divine law and natural law. Got it? Okay, but there's this third thing that shapes us, and I'm going to call it something like culture or society or social context. And this is all of the stuff out there in the world, okay? Now, here's the thing that's happening right this minute, wherever you go. The social and cultural context is trying to push you in one direction in all kinds of ways. Some of them are very overt and obvious. Some of them are very subtle and sneaky. But there's an attempt to try to shape you and bend you and mold you in that direction, okay? And the only way to resist that bending is to be deeply grounded both in the scriptures and in the way God made you. You need both of them. Because if you only say the scriptures, then here's what will happen. If you and this is going to sound a little bit weird because we're Bible people here, right? If you say, I only want to be rooted in the scriptures, it doesn't matter if I really think about the way God made me and nature and reality, then what will happen is you will think reality is Plato and all of those worldly people out there want to shape reality in a worldly way. And I'm a Christian, and I want to shape reality in a Christian way, but both of us are trying to take something that is just Plato. It has no shape, and we want, and it's like a fight. Who's going to get to control the Plato? Does that make sense? And if you think of, say something like manhood and womanhood in that way, then there's going to be a little bit of an anxiety in your heart that maybe they're right. Maybe they'll actually be able to pull it off. Maybe they can take the Plato and they can make it into this progressive, sexual revolutionary thing, and it will work. And what keeps you from believing that is not just knowing God says this in the Bible, but that what God says in the Bible fits with how he made the world. And so that when they're trying to bend things, they're not trying to bend or shape Plato. They're trying to bend and shape something that God has fixed and established. Does that make sense? Like, you need to know in your bones that underneath what you think and how you act as a man or a woman is both what God says in his word and how he made you in the world. So that's what we're going to try to focus on today, is both of those, because Genesis 1, 2, and 3 are dealing with both. It's the Bible, but it's talking about how God made you. Does that make sense? All right, so with that, let's begin Genesis 1. So I've got a bunch of different things. They're kind of like bullet point observations about what we see in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 about manhood and womanhood, and I'll pause and make some observations and connect some dots as we go. So number one, in Genesis chapter 1, we're told both men and women are made in God's image. This is actually very, very important, but because we've been... We live in a Christian society or a post-Christian society, one that's been very influenced by the scriptures historically, like 2,000 years after Jesus. This actually feels to us like, well, of course men and women are both made in God's image. In the ancient world, this was not obvious. In the kind of world in which like Moses lived or the ancient Babylonians, it was not obvious that men and women would both be able to image God. In fact, in the ancient world, women were often regarded as second-rate men. There was men, and then there was like the oops, the women. Right? It's really, really bad. You go read ancient literature. Some of you guys do this in your schools or your homeschools. You go to a college like this. You go to a college like Bethlehem. You're going to read ancient stuff, and you're going to just be like, "Whoa, that's what they thought about women? It's awful." But in the Bible, in the very first chapter, like first thing off the bat in speaking about humanity, God says, both men and women are my image bearers. Both of them represent me and show what I'm like. That's a big deal. All right. Number two, men and women have a shared mission. Okay, men and women have a shared mission. This, again, is in Genesis 1. We've talked about it. I'm just underscoring some things we've already seen here. Okay, both of them are crucial in accomplishing that mission. Fruitfulness, multiplication, and filling the earth are quite literally impossible without both men and women. Like, it ain't gonna work. Okay? When God invented procreation, conceiving and bearing children, when God invented that, he made both men and women essential to accomplishing it. It will not work with only one half. It's a fundamental biological fact. It's nature. It's woven into the fabric of the world. So I want you to just ponder this with me for a minute, okay? Each of you as an individual has your own digestive system. You got a mouth, you got a throat, you got a stomach, you got intestines, you got the rest. I'm not gonna go there, all right? Each of you has your own auditory system. You have the outer ear, you've got the inner ear, you've got that little drum, you've got your own. Each of you has your own nervous system. You've got a brain, you've got a spine, you've got all of the nerve endings running out. Each of you has your own systems with your own organs. Everything you need to see or hear or touch or feel or consume food and drink or expel waste, everything you need for those things, you have as an individual. Got me? But you cannot bear children alone. You only have half of the human reproductive system. Half of it. And a man has half and a woman has half. And in order to have the full system, you have to have both of them together. And this is part of our nature, and we're used to it. But I just want you to ponder for a second. What if, this is going to be weird. It's about to get weird. What if digesting your food required another person? But that'd be weird, right? Like, one of you eats and chews, and the other one, like, does something else, like the rest of it, you know? That would be weird. You would be like right now you're thinking, I can't even fathom how that would work. Okay? But when God, and so If you go back when God invented it, like when he invented these systems as a part of making us as bodily creatures, God invented it and he said, when I'm going to introduce procreation, multiplication, fruitfulness, I'm going to make it so that you have to have two different people that are very different from one another in order to make that possible. In order to make new people, we're going to have two different kinds of people to do two very different kinds of things. It's very, very profound to think about the way God made you. So we have a shared mission. The fruitfulness, multiplication, and filling requires both. And not only that, but the mission to subdue the earth and rule it is given not just to men, but to men and women. That commission in Genesis 1, ruling the earth, requires both kings and queens. Kings and queens. They're both essential. Now, notice that as I've talked in all of this, okay, as I've been unpacking it, there's a word that you might have expected me to say that I have intentionally not used, okay? I've avoided using the word equality, and there's a reason. It's deliberate. It's not because I think we should never use it. It's a fine word to say both men and women equally bear God's image, or both men and women equally share in God's mission, or something like that. But in the modern world, I think we have to be careful about our use of the word equality, and here's why. To many people, the word equal carries the connotation interchangeable or identical. Okay? To many people, if you say something is equal, it means they're identical in all of the relevant ways, and you can just switch them out. And men and women are not like that. They both bear God's image, and they are both necessary to accomplish God's mission, but they are not interchangeable. Right? I remember one time, this is one of those ways that the culture tries to kind of shape you. This was probably during like Pride Month. We just had, you know, Pride Month. I don't know if you live in a major city. We live in a major city, Minneapolis. And everywhere you go, like every business is like falling over themselves to like get on the train. And like, you're like, why does the hardware store have a rainbow flag? Like, what? Like that's just a, you know, it's just a hot dog stand, but like he's got like a big banner. What's the deal? So everybody's falling over themselves. Look, we're cool. We're on the team. We're going with the revolution. Okay? So one year during Pride Month, there was like an ad on Twitter, and it was like an airline. I'm probably Delta. Okay? Just because that's the sort of thing Delta would do. No, I said it could have been any of them, but I think it was Delta. And it said, and it showed the seat belts. Okay? You know, like the buckles on the seat belts. And it says, and it said something like, buckle to whoever you want. And it showed like the, so male and female. This is, we actually called it like when you plug in an outlet, you've got the male part and the female part that you plug in because that's, we just use the, you guys do this? Okay, I just want to make sure. So, like there's like five kids out there that are like, what is he talking about? You know? Okay, you guys are all with me, okay? So you got the male part and the female part, and it's like those are sitting next to each other, and then there's like the like two male parts of the seatbelt, and they're next to each other, and then there's two female parts sitting next to each other, and the headline is, buckle however you want. And I'm like, not if you want to live. like the dude who's got two of the same thing, and like the plane's going down, and he's like bouncing around, and I'm sitting there buckled going, see? Okay. Okay? So, I mean, it was this grand irony, because here they are trying to make this really, like, cool, edgy point. Like, hey, we're an airline. We have seat belts. And so we're going to make this cool point about you can buckle whoever you want. And it's like, no, you can't. You really, really can't. Not if you want to live. Okay. So that's the point. When people hear equal, they think interchangeable. They think buckle whoever you want. That's going to be in jeopardy tomorrow, I'm pretty sure. That buckle whoever you want is going to be on jeopardy. Both men and women bear God's image, but they are not identical. They are complementary. There is an asymmetry, a difference, but a fitness between men and women. There are important differences, but these differences, this is really important. They are not differences from each other so much as differences for each other. You see the difference from that? Like, if you say we're different from each other, that's true, but it like kind of pushes, like, you should think, here's a man, here's a woman, we're different from each other, right? Like, away from each other. But what the Bible's telling us is men and women are different, but they're different for each other. They fit like the seatbelt. These differences, like all of God's gifts, are given to us for our enjoyment and for God's mission so that we can know and love him better. So now I want to talk about some of the differences. We've got shared image bearing, shared mission. Now, what are these differences? Number one, as we look at these differences, this is important. There is no absolute superiority or inferiority between men and women. This is what most people want to, this is the good thing they're trying to get at when they say men and women are equal. There's no absolute superiority or inferiority. Chesterton has this great poem, it's one of my favorites. He says, "If I set the sun beside the moon, and if I set the land beside the sea, and if I set the town beside the country, and if I set the man beside the woman, I suppose some fool would talk about one of them being better." Got that? So the idea is, which is better, the sun and the moon, the sun or the moon? And it's like neither, like they're not better. Like the sun is better at being the sun, but the sun is a lousy moon. Right? And the moon is better at being the moon, but would make a lousy sun. Right? The sea is very good at being wet, okay? But would be a lousy place to stand, unless you're Jesus and Peter for like 5 minutes. But that's different, okay? But the sea is very good at being wet and very bad at being dry. In the same way, men are better than women at being men. And women are better than men at being women. But there's no, that's a relative better, not an absolute better. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's the first thing as we talk about these differences. Okay. So here's what we see in Genesis 1 and 2. Number one, few observations. Adam was made first. God makes Adam and places him in the garden to work and keep it. And then a little while later, God builds woman from the man's side. That's Genesis chapter 2. He's placed in the garden in verse 7. And then later in verse 21, 22 is when she's built. Number two, we talked about this already. Adam learns it's not good for him to be alone through naming the animals. You get 5.5 days, Genesis chapter 1. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. You get to the middle of day 6 and God goes, not good. Not good. And God shows Adam that it's not good by bringing these mated pairs of animals to him to name him so that Adam sees and recognizes there is something missing here and builds expectation for God to meet that need. Number three, we're told that why God makes the woman in a very specific way. In Genesis 2... 18, it's not good for man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him, a suitable, appropriate, fitting. That's they're for each other, a suitable helper. So a woman is made for man, to help man. Okay, that's number three. Number four, the making of woman involves two different things. On the one hand, it's a construction project. The word that that the Bible uses for God made the woman, the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made. I have a little footnote in my Bible. Maybe some of you have it in yours. This is verse 22. It's the word for build. God builds a woman from the rib, okay? And this construction project involves a kind of death and resurrection. Did you ever notice this? So Adam names all of the animals, finds no helper. God puts him into a deep death-like sleep, like just knocks him out into a deep sleep. And while he's in that sleep, Adam loses something, right? Like he has surgery, like that rib gets taken out, part of his side. And then he awakes to the stunning reality that he actually didn't lose anything. He didn't lose anything. This is better. This is fitting. This exceeds all of his expectations. So he dies, he loses something, and he's raised, and it's better. You see that? That's death and resurrection before the fall. Before the fall. Adam dies and he's raised. He's moved from one degree of glory to another. One degree of glory to another. The woman, the creation of the woman, is an act of glorification. Woman is the glory of man. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. That's what Paul says. So, in other words, what God does here with Adam is the same thing that he was doing in Genesis 1 with the cosmos. So you remember that God, like there, all of the waters, like the formless waters are there, and then God says, I'm going to divide these things and then kind of bring them back together. I'm going to separate the waters, put them in the sky, and now there's like an order to it, a structure, and it's better. And then God says, here's all of these waters down here. I'm going to separate out the land, and that's going to be better. And this is what God does again and again. He separates things and then unites them back together in a more glorious way. Adam's unity as an individual is not good compared to the separation and the union of man and woman. Number five, the glory of this moment. So I'm saying the creation of woman is an act, it's a construction project, and it's a glorious one. The glory of that moment is not lost on Adam, okay? So God wakes Adam up, brings the woman to the man. Adam takes one look at her, and then he erupts. He's like, whoa, man. That's a good name. That's my other youth group joke. You guys now have both of them. The first recorded human words in the Bible, the first recorded human words in the Bible are a hymn of praise to another creature. Adam praising his wife. This at last is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. In other words, Adam is saying, look, he sees her. After all of that naming, he sees her and he goes, you come from me, but you are not me. Your bones were built from my bones. Your flesh was cut from my flesh. Like, we're alike. Like, we're more alike than I'm like the animals, but we're different still. We are the same, but we've been sundered. God has torn me in two, and now he's putting me back together. He took out a piece of my side so that he could give it back to me with interest. What name is going to capture what I'm feeling in this moment? She shall be called woman, Isha. Because she was taken out of Ish. So God splits the man to put him back together, and every marriage since then has involved that same thing, a separation, a leaving, for the sake of a greater and more fruitful union, a cleaving. Now let's draw out some implications of all of this, okay? Why does this matter? This progression, this asymmetry, this difference, as God makes and builds Adam and Eve, What can we learn from it? Well, according to Paul, the reason that pastors must be men and the reason that husbands are the head of their wives is because of what happens in that passage. Adam is created first and then Eve. And Eve is made from Adam. And that order of creation, according to Paul, is really important. If you don't understand that God has created us in a certain way, in a certain order, with certain distinctives, then all of those later commands in Scripture where God is like, the husband is the head of his wife, and pastor, I don't permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man in church, all of those sort of things will not make sense. They will seem arbitrary. It seems like God's being unfair. But if you pay attention to the order of how God did things, you see the wisdom in his words. That's why we're looking at this passage. It helps us see the why underneath the what. The why underneath the what. What has God told us to do? How has he told us to live? Genesis 1 to 4 gives us the patterns so that we can see the why. In making Adam first and then Eve, and in making Eve from Adam, the biblical authors see that God is establishing a certain order in the nature of things which our lives and our language should reflect. So the order of creation means Adam is head over his wife, and that headship takes the form of provision, protection, and sacrifice for her good. I'll come back to that in a moment. She is taken out of man in order to be the glory of man. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11. Woman is the glory of man. And Adam is called to labor so that her beauty shines. He's to guard and protect her and their marriage in the same way that he is to guard and protect the garden. That's why, this is really important, the test of whether genuine, godly masculinity is present. Like, if you go to a church, you go to a school, and you're like, is there godly masculinity here? What should you look at? You should look to see whether the women are thriving. You go someplace and you say, are there godly men here? Well, are there thriving women here? If there are thriving women, why are they thriving? Because there's godly masculinity to provide and protect. If it's beautiful, that's why. That's what's feeding it. And so on the one hand, this is necessary in order for the beauty, and the beauty is the fulfillment of all of that protection. Does that make sense? Like they fit. They fit. Now, this passage doesn't simply show us the origin of masculine headship. Adam was made first and then Eve. It also shows us their dependence. Like when Adam names the woman, he's the Hebrew words for that when he says she shall be called woman, she was taken out of man, are different. So earlier in the passage, he's been called Adam. That's the word, the generic word for man. Now he says she shall be called Isha because she was taken out of Ish. Do you hear the connection in the sound? Isha and Ish. It's similar. We do it in English. Woman and man, right? The same letters show up. And so that's a good thing. It's establishing these two things are mutually dependent on each other. Like they fit each other. It's meant to, that linguistic similarity to our ears is meant to remind us that men and women are dependent on each other. So when Paul looks at this, he says, in the beginning, woman was taken out of man in Genesis. And ever since then, every man who has ever lived was taken out of a woman, his mother. Right? So Eve was made out of Adam, and every man was born of woman. And so Paul says, and therefore they're mutually dependent. That's what God's trying to say. They need each other. And all of this, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, is from God. So this relationship of origin and then glory, of beautifying and helping, of response and initiative, of order and dependence is a beautiful thing. It's a gift from a God who meets our needs. Now, one other little bit on this. Where did Adam learn to do this? So he's naming, right? He's looking at her, you're bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. You should be called woman because she was taken out of, you should be called Ish because she was taken out of, no, you should be called Isha because she was taken out of Ish. How did he know how to do that? Here's a fun deal, okay? I'm going to argue that Adam learned to name by imitating God. And all you need to know is that Adam knows his name and where he came from. Okay? So who knows what the Hebrew word for Adam is? It's Adam. It's Adam. That's how you know it's Hebrew, because it sounds like that. So if there's any Adams in here, you can just walk up to people and be like, actually, my name's Adam. So Adam, now, do you know why Adam is named that? Does anybody know what the Hebrew word for dust is, for ground? Adama. So Adam was formed from the dust of the Adama. Does that make sense? So God says, Adam, you came out of the Adama, and so your name is Adam. And then he says, all right, Adam, now you name her. And so Adam goes, I think I can do this. Okay. I am Adam, and I was taken out of the Adama. She then is Isha because she was taken out of Ish. You see it? Like the he learned name the per. He names her based on where she came from because he was named by where he came from. Does that make sense? They name based on origins here, and so Adam does just what he sees his father doing. He imitates God. All right. Keep in mind that importance of origins in a minute. Adam from the ground, woman from man. It'll be important. Now, we're going to look in a minute at how sin corrupts this, but I'm going to fly through this part here. I just want to give you a brief summary definition of masculinity and femininity, and then we're going to look at how sin messes it up. Here's masculine. This is partly from Genesis, partly from the rest of the Bible, partly from just paying attention to the way the world works, okay? So this is kind of a summary definition. It's not original to me, or at least the basic one isn't. I think it's Pastor Wilson's. He's the one who formulated it this way, and it's a good one. Masculinity is the glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. Masculinity is the glad. That word matters. It's happy. It's cheerful. Glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. It involves taking initiative, taking responsibility for your actions and for those under your care. It involves provision and protection. My favorite way of summarizing it comes from Narnia. Okay? This is what it means to be a king. This is King Loon to his kids. This is what it means to be a king. To be first in every desperate attack. To be last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and again in bad years, to wear finer clothes and laugh louder at a scantier meal than any man in your land. This is what it means to be a king. First in, last out, laughing loudest. Glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. First in, last out, laughing loudest. Now, that doesn't mean that women won't sacrifice and that they should do so cheerfully. That's not what that means. It means men should do it first. Like when, if there's a burden to be borne, you bear it first. That's why God gave you big shoulders, because he wants you to carry stuff. Okay? If a man will see to it that pain and hardship fall in his lap before they ever fall upon his wife or his children or those under his care. And too many men think that male headship means I get to be the boss. It doesn't mean you get to be the boss. It means you get to die first. Congratulations. Now, when it comes to young men, since you guys are young men, Paul, in the New Testament, singles out self-control as the fundamental need for young men. Every time Paul says to like Timothy or Titus, he's like, hey, I need you to tell the young guy something. Every time he's like, tell him to be self-controlled. Tell him to be self-controlled. Self-control is a fruit of the Spirit. It's a result of the grace of God in the gospel. But one of the fundamental things that the Spirit of God is doing in your life is restoring control of you to you. You're restoring control of you to you. The glory of young men is their strength, but inactive strength is idleness and passivity. Just like what Adam did when the serpent came. So strength needs to be directed somewhere. On the other hand, unbridled strength is reckless and dangerous, and that causes harm and destruction. That's what Adam's doing when kill her, not me. So strength needs to be governed by wisdom, guided by the Spirit of God for the good of others. That's what God is after when it comes to men. Now, that's masculinity, okay? It's a little picture. Femininity, here's the definition, is the glad assumption of helping and supporting in accomplishing God's mission. And I get that because she's called the helper. And helper, this is one of those places where people go, oh, she's the helper. That must mean she's second best. It's like, no. Do you know who else is called helper in the Bible? God. God is our help. It's the same word, okay? So it's not an inferiority. It's just a different place. It's the task was fundamentally given to Adam, work and keep the garden, and then she is called on to help and assist him. This is why Paul will say, the woman was made for man, not man for the woman. Okay, he's made first and given a task. She's made second and help and is designed to help him in that task. And there's no inferiority, but there's no sameness either. So here's what femininity then involves. It involves responding to initiative. If men are to initiate, women ought to respond. But it also, and then using gifts and talents to fill up and fill out the glory of creation. But it's not just like women wait around till men do stuff. Okay? That's not the way it works. Oftentimes in the scriptures and in reality, you guys all know this, women are the inspiration for men's initiative. Okay? And everybody laughed because y'all were like thinking about something that happened yesterday, probably. Some guy was doing something stupid and everybody knew why. No. A man will climb mountains, swim oceans, kill dragons in order to impress and win the affections of a woman. He will. Often, men will rise or fall to the expectations of women. If she has high expectations, he will stand up straighter in order to meet them. If she has low ones, he will stoop in order to meet them. In marriage, helping and supporting men takes the form of glad submission to a husband's headship. That's what femininity looks like in marriage. But it's important to note that you women are not called on to submit to every man. You're not. You're absolutely 100% not. You're called to submit to the men that God places over you in particular. That's your father, and then later it will be your husband. And that submission is designed to keep you from having to submit to all of the other yokels who want to get you to do stuff. All right. We could fill this out a little bit more, but I don't have time. So here's the last exhortation on that. The best way for you to learn what it means to be a man or a woman is not to try to be a man or a woman. Okay? This is big. You don't grow up to be a man by trying really, really, really hard to be a man. If you try really, really hard to be a man, it actually doesn't look very manly. Or if you try really, really hard to be a woman, it doesn't look actually very feminine or attractive. Instead, here's what you should know. You are a man. Or you are a woman. You are right now by nature. That's how God built you. And so instead, grow up to be a godly man or a godly woman by aiming for godliness. And because you're a man, that godliness will express itself in masculine ways. And if you're a woman, that godliness will express itself in feminine ways. And so the way you do it is, I'm going to aim for godliness, and I'm going to have wise, older people who are going to be models for me. And so I'm going to grow up into masculinity and femininity by pursuing God, not mainly by pursuing masculinity. Does that make sense? You're like, no. It's like, okay, if it didn't make sense, just go spend time with wise, older people. That's it. All right, here's the effects of sin. I'm going to skip that part. Okay. Curse. This is the effects of sin in the fall. We sometimes say that God curses Adam and Eve after the fall. But it seems significant to me that the only person in Genesis 3 who's actually cursed directly is the serpent. God says to the serpent, "Cursed are you." When he talks to Adam and Eve, he doesn't say, "Cursed are you." Instead, he says, "I will multiply your pain in childbearing, and cursed is the ground because of you." That's important. We want to think about why. The curse is specific. He doesn't just give a generic curse like, "Humans, you are cursed," or "Stuff is cursed because of you humans." He looks at the woman and says, "There's a specific curse in relation to you." And he looks at the man and says, "There's a specific curse in relation to you," because the curse falls on us as men and as women. So how does it work? Now, to understand the difference, remember what I said a second ago. Adam was taken from the Adamah, from the ground, and the woman was taken out of the man, okay? That means Adam is taken out of the ground, and he's oriented to the ground. Taken out, now work it. Got it? Adam's taken out of the ground, now work the ground, Adam. Eve is taken out of Adam and then told, "Help Adam." You follow that? Taken out of the ground, work the ground. Taken out of Adam, help Adam. Eve was taken out of Adam and oriented to Adam. Paul says woman was made for man. So he and their children is her fundamental calling. And that fact that your origin determines your orientation is, I think, the Bible's explanation for the general tendency for men to be oriented outward and to be thing-oriented. Guys like talking about stuff and doing stuff. Like, we make friendships not by looking at each other, but mainly by doing stuff together. And like, if you want to talk about, "Hey man, let's talk about our friendship," it's like, "No, I don't really want to." whereas women actually, in general, not every woman, but in general, women actually enjoy talking about the relationship itself. And they form relationships differently than men do. And the Bible's saying the reason for that is that men are taken out of the ground and fundamentally oriented outward to do that, and women is taken out of another person and is oriented to a person, and so men tend to be thing-oriented and women tend to be people-oriented. Now, if you're an exception to that, you don't need to think like, "Oh no, I'm sinning because I'm not like that. Like, I'm a girl and I actually like stuff, and or I'm a dude and I like relationships are great." You just need to know. Here's the deal. You just need to know that you're an outlier. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it's not sinful in itself. You're still going to, if you're a man, but you're very relationally oriented in the way and form friendships more the way women do, you're still a man. You're still a man. And if you're a woman and you really like to do activities and you get really thing-oriented, you like to talk about stuff, okay? That's okay. You're still a woman, okay? But in general, there's tendencies, okay? That's the kind of qualification stuff that I'm not going to have time to do enough of. Okay, so here's the curse on woman. "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband. He shall rule over you." So So what's cursed? What's going to be painful for her? Answer, her relationships. Her relationships. Her work as his helper and ally. God created woman to be the companion and the helper of her husband in their joint task and their bearer of the children, and both of those are now going to be broken and painful because of their sin. And the phrase, your desire shall be for your husband, is ambiguous and is controversial. That phrase shows up two other places in the Bible. One of them is in Genesis 4:7, one chapter later, and it's when God says to Cain, sin is crouching at your door, its desire is for you, and you must rule over it. And that sounds very similar, right? Like, so sin wants to like conquer Cain, and Cain needs to crush sin. And what God says to Eve is, you're going to want to desire your husband, and then your husband's going to want to rule in a very negative way, not benevolent, good headship, but harsh, oppressive rule. That's what's going to happen. So the other place is Songs, where I am my beloved's and his desire is for me. That's the other place the phrase shows up. So here's how this works. In both cases, there's this idea of possession. So the curse in relation to woman is a possession, a sense of ownership. A lover wants to possess the beloved. Sin desires to possess and devour us. And so women, apart from God in a cursed world, a woman will want to possess her husband and by extension, children and other people as well in excessive ways. That's going to be fundamental to, like that's the struggle for many women. It will take different forms. It could be like a kind of neediness, like a hunger for affection. Please love me. Please love me. I need you. I'm very needy. It could be the form of manipulation. I'm going to try to get what I want from you by manipulating. It could be just outright possessiveness. Like C.S. Lewis, this is one of my favorite quotes. He goes, she was the sort of woman who lived for others, and you could always tell the others by their hunted expression. You know, like they're like, where is she? Okay. He called them maternal vampires. Ouch. Or it could actually be in the form of, I want to be the boss over my husband, or I want to be the boss over men. In whatever form, without God, she's going to want more from the relationships than they can deliver. She was made for relationships, but without God at the center, they will be more important to her than it will, and they will inevitably disappoint and frustrate and cause pain for her. And the capstone of that is that she's going to be at the mercy of a man who just accused her and blamed her to save his own skin. She will want to possess him in the way that sin wants to possess Cain, and rather than sacrificing for her, her husband will respond with hostility and domination over her. That's the curse. Adam, what's the curse for him? Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. We talked about dust already. So Eve was taken out of Adam, and the relationship is cursed. Adam was taken from the ground, and the ground is cursed. All of his dreams of expanding the garden and taming the land and subduing the earth, all of those are now painful dreams. The ground is going to fight you. Before, it was just going to be fun. Now it's going to be a fight. Those shrubs, they were meant to be gentle and easy to cultivate. You go out in the world, you start cultivating, and now they're going to be thorns and thistles. Labor and work, they were supposed to be a delight. You were supposed to be energized by it. Now they will be hard and painful and vain. Like Adam, you will work hard your whole life. You will sweat and you will bleed to eat and provide, and then you will die and you will not enjoy it anymore. You will, in fact, this is the book of Ecclesiastes. You're going to work really hard. You're going to build this awesome thing, and then you're going to die, and your son's going to get it, and he's an idiot. That's how Ecclesiastes talks. That's the vanity and the curse for the man. Just as Eve will want more from her work, namely her children, her relationships, than they can deliver, now Adam, without God, will want more from his work than it can deliver, and it will frustrate him. And the irony is, in the same way that originally our differences were differences for each other to serve and help each other, now those differences are going to frustrate each other. So that the more that a guy pours himself into his work, the more that his wife is going to be like, I need you, I need you. And the more that she gets clingy, the more he's going to run to his work. And the more that he runs to his work, the more that she's going to get clingy. And the amazing thing is that in like a few short verses, the Bible basically describes like 90% of marital conflict. All right. Apart from Jesus, that's all there is. That's all there is. Thank God that's not all there is. Let's end this way. Part of the curse is the tendency for men and women to excessively need each other and then to despise each other. This is where the whole idea of the battle of the sexes come from, where like men are always puffing out their chest, oh, it's good to be a man, and women suck. And then women are like, men, they're awful. We hate men. And there's just this kind of like competition and rivalry and hatred that can flourish between men and women. But our differences were not meant to be against each other, weapons. They were meant to be for each other. Masculine strength becomes oppressive. Feminine beauty becomes a snare. And that battle of the sexes escalates. Men and women begin to despise each other. And then the final step, according to Paul, is when God gives men and women over to degraded passions, to dishonorable passions, and women exchange the natural relations for those contrary to nature. And men give up natural relations and are consumed with passion for one another. Men hate femininity so much that they run to other men. And sometimes that dark exchange is voluntary, like it's a choice. And other times, sinful desires just kind of come. They're just unchosen. And so I'm just going to say something real quick here. Sexuality in the modern world is deeply broken. And I'm not ignorant enough to think that in this room, it's not deeply broken in all kinds of ways. Okay? Like I am absolutely sure that in this room, there is deep sexual brokenness. So I just want to say a couple of things to you in your sexual brokenness. Number one, God loves you. He really loves you. In all of your brokenness, He really loves you. Number two, every human being is broken in their sexuality. Every one of us. All of our desires by nature, born into a broken world, are disordered and destructive in some way or another. You are not alone in having broken desires. I do too. And there's a particular kind of shame that comes from a Christian when they see the goodness of God's design and they say, I want that, and I know I am nowhere close to that. And it's the kind of shame that drives you underground. It's the kind of thing that makes you do the Adam and Eve thing. I'm going to hide. I'm going to do fig leaves. I'm going to run away. And so third, I just want to encourage you, believe the gospel. Like really believe that God is for you and surround yourself with people who are going to remind you of that and welcome you in Jesus' name. Move toward community. Like be honest with people about your struggles. Invite other faithful Christians in. Because here's the deal, hidden sins kill Christians because they're hidden. That's true of same-sex attraction. It's true of pornography use. It's true of fornication. It's true of all of that. Okay, you guys are living in the aftermath of the sexual revolution, and you are collateral damage. Now, me, as I close here, first, let me send you one more place. If that's you, if you're in the sexual brokenness box and you feel trapped, a number of years ago at my church, I did like a 4-session thing on healing and confessing and dealing, fighting sexual sin, okay? So if you go, if that's you and you want to go get some help, go online and you just search my name, Rigney, Pure Pleasure. okay? And there's a little conference at Bethlehem Baptist Church. You go search that, and there's about four. Another guy gave a couple talks. I gave four talks. And listen to that with somebody. Like, get a friend, get your parents, get some mentor, whoever you got, and you listen to that together, and you guys get to work on it. There's hope. There really is hope. At your age, I was deeply, deeply broken sexually. And God has done a great and marvelous work. Here's the last thing. Do Adam and Eve get saved? Like, will they be in heaven? They sin, they get kicked out of the garden. You ever thought about that? Like, do Adam and Eve get saved? Now, on the one hand, they get clothed. That's a good sign. They get clothed with blood, bloody animal skins. I want to show you one reason why that did sound weird. I got it. One sign that they believed, okay? So you remember the promise, the threat of God? The day you eat of it, you will surely die, okay? And then they ate of it, and then God kicks them out of the garden, so they're now cut off from the tree of life, and now they're going to die. They don't have access to the tree that would maintain their bodies and their lives, and so now their bodies are going to die. It's going to take time, a couple hundred years, because their bodies were really strong from eating that tree of life, and now it's going to take time, but they're going to die, okay? But in the curse on the serpent, did you notice something? So you got to think, you're Adam, you just got caught. You just got caught. I ate. In the day you eat of it, you will die. I ate. And then here's what you hear God say to the serpent. Because you've done this, cursed are you above all livestock, above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. So you're Adam sitting there, hangdog look, listening to God do that to the serpent, and you're going, I'm next. He's going to curse me next, and I'm dead. And then God says this, I will put enmity between you, serpent, and the woman, and between your offspring, serpent, and her offspring. And at that moment, I cannot help but believe Adam did this. Did he just say offspring? We're going to have kids? We're still going to have kids? We're not going to die? I'm not going to die? He shall bruise your head, you shall crush his heel. So in the midst of that, God says, you're going to have kids. And Adam has to go, I'm not going to die. Now, did Adam believe that? Did Adam believe that there will be a skull crusher to come to crush the serpent and restore everything? Did Adam believe that? You know how I know? You know why I think he believed it? Because before they have kids, Adam gives his wife a new name. What's her new name? Ish and Isha. That's the generic word for male and, for man and woman. What's her new name? Which means?
Mother of offspring.
Mother of all living. Her name is life. Her name is life. And so Adam, after this encounter with God of judgment, where God mingles mercy with judgment, like we talked about yesterday, Adam comes out of that, and the very first thing he does when he comes out of it is he looks at his wife and he says, I need to give you a personal name. You know what your name is, honey? It's life. God is going to give us life before she has children. Like, there are no kids at this point, but you are the mother of all living. I believe the promises of God. Life will conquer death. And so Adam believes and he speaks. And that's my final exhortation to you in all of this. Believe it. The gospel, the good design for men and women, get it into your bones and live it. And then out of that, speak. Let's pray. Father, give us faith. Root us and ground us in your truth. Help us to know in our bones the goodness of what it means to be a man and a woman. And help us to then speak, to shine like stars in the midst of a crooked and depraved generation, to be the kind of people who welcome refugees, sexual refugees from the world who are broken and collateral damage. Help us to welcome them in Jesus' name and point them to the God who can heal them because you've healed us. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
You think of yourself now, and then in 4 years' time, what do you want yourself to look like? And is the education that you're considering going to help you get to that place?
When you're a student, you want to become like your teacher. You're going to become like your teacher. Looking at NSA beforehand, I knew I wanted to become like the men who are teaching here.
Fireman, husband, father, doctor, no matter where you want to go,
NSA is just such good preparation for the person that you want to be.
If you want to be an effective Christian, you need to be able to lead and shape culture. If you want to do that, no matter what your occupation is, you need to shape yourself, prepare yourself as a person for that job. And liberal arts is, I think, the best education you can have for that.
To learn more, check us out online at nsa.edu.